And that was XTC with Dear God, and the last tune played by the last show, Ear Buddies. Thanks, Ear Buddies, for the plug for the show for the next 2 hours, Socialist Alternative Radio, talk and music from a working class democratic socialist perspective. And here in the area we're broadcasting from, Somerville, Medford, Massachusetts, the weather's not too good, so I don't think we're going to have our guest co-host today, Diego, although he was going to show up. Maybe he'll be here a little later. So it looks like it's me, Jeff, with you for the next 2 hours, talking music once again, with a theme of, well, not just alternative information, alternative news from a progressive or socialist standpoint, but, well, those are two different things. I shouldn't conflate them, but it's really about more about doing whatever our little modest part here to get out the word that there is a socialist movement out there. There is actually ways to get organized as a socialist, as someone with a method of analysis based on Marxism, and that you can join this movement, and that's growing in the United States and around the world, and, you know, create fundamental social change to get rid of capitalism and bring about a socialist system, which I used to say democratic socialism. I'm kind of veering away from that now because of a lot of sort of liberal usurpation, a lot of sort of liberal taking of that term, and redefining it to mean capitalism, some sort of capitalism, like AOC, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, the darling of the liberal of liberalism. She's not a socialist. She recently said you can be a capitalist and a democratic socialist. Well, guess what? You can't. Unless you change the term democratic socialism to mean something innocuous and kind of irrational based on the way that that term has been used. Sanders is the same way, defining socialism as FDR, Lyndon Johnson, Scandinavian countries. Please, if you can afford it, if you can get some rich moron to pay for you to go off to Scandinavia, please go, because you're not going to find socialism there when you get there. You're going to find inequality. You're going to find in Sweden a tearing away and destruction of the social welfare system that grew in a certain time period for certain historical reasons, which we can talk about. We love digressing here on the show. But just to finish the little thought here, that what's being touted as socialism or democratic socialism these days in the United States, and this has happened in other countries too, is very, very suspect. And you should examine that. You should think about it. You should find out more. But back to the original point, you know, this show is about getting people involved in activity, including education for themselves and for others about socialism, but really activity of, you know, protesting against the Trump administration, getting independent socialists elected to office where possible, local level right now. I mean, it could happen nationally too, but Sanders has kind of ruined that by throwing his lot in as he did many, many years ago. But it seems to be people have short memories and it's not their fault, and we understand why. But Sanders has basically supported the Democratic Party since the early 80s. He flirted with flirted with building a what's known as a third party here. I don't like that term because there should be multiple parties, not just two or three. But he helped start the Progressive Party in Vermont, but never joined it. We actually have some news about the Progressive Party in Vermont. They just won more seats on the Burlington City Council. I don't really know that much about them now, but I did follow them when back in the day when Sanders was around that. And he never joined. And then he made deals with the Democrats going back to early, you know, 84, and then cemented that in 92 when I was at the Kennedy School, a sort of liberal think tank run by Harvard University. And he just basically said, look, they said to each other, look, we won't, the DNC, the Democratic Party Corporation, so to speak, because that's what they define themselves as, is not going to challenge you in Vermont, but in exchange, we would like you to promote the national candidates of the Democratic Party, especially for president, in Vermont. Sanders took it a step further. He's been gone all over the country promoting Senate candidates even before his recent notoriety. For years, he was raising big money for Democratic Party Senate candidates and so on. And Sanders, of course, blocked with the Democrats in Congress, voted, according to Howard Dean of Vermont, Sanders voted more Democratic than most Democrats when in Congress. And he's still there doing that, basically. But some people get confused because he liked to say he was an independent, even when he wasn't functioning as one. And so we have some news about that, too, which we'll hopefully get to, where he basically has said, I mean, he said the other day when he was in Iowa that if he loses the nomination again, he will, the Democratic Party nomination, he will support whatever Democratic Party candidate is put forward because we need to beat Trump, you know, the whole lesser evilism thing. Sure, we need to beat Trump, but we need to beat Trumpism more importantly, or we need to beat where Trump comes from. And Trump actually comes from partially the disappointment of millions of people in liberal policies that did not improve their living standards or their future, their ability to see a decent future for themselves and their children. So some of them, I mean, and this is a bad thing, this is an ignorant thing to do, but they, given the duopoly in America, it's not surprising. We're taught from birth that there's only two political parties and you have to vote for one or the other. So if people get, if you're in a city or a state where austerity measures and cuts in schools and other, you know, high unemployment, rotten economy going on locally, et cetera, and the Democrats are in power and in many states in power perpetually, forever, like in Massachusetts, then what are you going to do? If you believe in voting as you're taught to believe in, then you're going to vote Republican or something. I mean, I never would. I scour the, as a socialist, I scour the voting, you know, the vote, the ballot. I scour the ballot for any progressive independents or progressive socialists. I'm sorry, I keep conflating those two words. They are related, but I scour the ballot for socialists to vote for, and they are out there. They are out there. We're going to talk about Kshama Sawant today, Kshama, second name Sawant. What is that surname? I don't know. Sawant, Sawant. Please Google Sawant, Kshama Sawant. And start reading about her. She's a socialist with Socialist Alternative, a member of Socialist Alternative, an open socialist, ran for election in 2013 for city council in Seattle, Washington, won, beat a 16-year incumbent, who, by the way, started out as a Green and quickly went over to the Democratic Party in 2000 when Nader ran. A bunch of Greens abandoned the Green Party because they didn't want to be really doing independent politics, a la Nader's independent Green Party run in 2000. So they abandoned that very quickly, three of them in Washington. So imagine you're sitting there in Seattle. Hey, I just elected these progressive Greens. Yay. And within a year, they're basically, we're really Democrats and we support, you know, the status quo. And this guy, Coughlin was his name, he stuck in there and supported the status quo, which was for most Seattle people, working people especially, a nightmare of gentrification and rising inequality and the rule of Amazon, Uber Alles. We're going to have a whole show on Amazon. I mean, you could have a whole show on Walmart, Amazon. It's not, the problem is capitalism, not just evil corporations versus good corporations. There's no such thing as a good corporation. Corporations, and even Ben and Jerry's exploits labor and nature for profit, you know. So at root, there's no such thing as a good corporation. In fact, there's this film that's extremely flawed. I don't really recommend it, but hey, whatever. It's called The Corporation. Came out early 2000s, I think. And it purported, I mean, its thesis was that there are good corporations, or you could have good corporations, but the corporation they followed most in the film is a liberal perspective of, you know, capitalism can be engineered somehow to go against its basic DNA of exploitation for profit. So they looked at this corporation that tried really, really hard. It's like a big rug company, tried really manufacturing rugs, tried really, really hard to be green, quote unquote, got about 30% of its production, which it by itself claimed was green. I mean, only 30%. So they never reached even near the goal. And you never heard of that corporation again, of course. And the people that made that film are probably, I don't know, CEOs of some NGO somewhere, voting Democrat and promoting the Democratic Party or whatever. But again, getting back to the main thread here, we're here, Social Alternative Radio. Check us out on Facebook. We're here to see if you're interested in getting involved with socialism. You know, there's organizations, Socialist Alternative, of course. There's others out there. Go to socialistalternative.org for more information. Go to socialistworld.net for information about the Committee for Workers International, which is a international grouping of socialist groups that and parties that Social Alternative is in political solidarity with. And there's ways, and you'll find out through there or other options, other gateways, that there is a socialist movement out there. It does need to define its terms through reality, through action and so on, and you'll find things out like, Venezuela never really was socialist, but it's labeled that. Or DSA, Democratic Socialist America, really isn't socialist, although it's labeled that because it supports the Democratic Party in the U.S. and wants to be part of the Democratic Party, wants to be the left wing of the Democratic Party, with some exceptions within of individuals within the organization, but in terms of its policies, it mostly promotes Democratic Party candidates. So, you know, you got to cut through some of the bull, some of the mislabeling. Socialism is not just welfare under capitalism or decent social programs under capitalism, although socialists do fight for anything. I mean, I think socialists should fight, and I think many do, for anything that will improve the lives of working people. You know, every reform is a good one to fight for, but if you limit yourself to those reforms under capitalism, they will obviously be taken away very quickly in many cases, sooner or later in others. I mean, think about the trajectory of working people's lives in the United States right now. Pensions are practically gone. Things like subsidized daycare, which was a big fight in the beginning in the 70s with the rise of the women's movement. We're going to talk about International Women's Day in a second. That's off the table, although it's starting to come back a little bit. And if you have kids like I do, you know, daycare is a nightmare. The costs of daycare are equivalent to entire salaries now. Housing subsidies that the greatest generation, quote unquote, got after World War II for at least white people, which is another thing. Check out a book called The Color of Law. I don't know if we'll have time to get to that, but segregated, well, the government and corporate policies that segregated American housing. The GI Bill included subsidies for low interest mortgages that were denied to black people, and only white workers were able to get them. And but even those subsidies are gone, and a lot of things that you know, wage increases indexed to inflation, haven't heard about that one recently much. Unions are at a low level of organization, although there's been more strikes in the last year, big strikes, than any time since 1986. So there's, and we talked about that in the last show, there's definitely cause for optimism as far as the labor movement fighting back. But many of the fights are still defensive, and it has to be accompanied by organizing new unions in new sectors and older sectors of the workplace, especially Amazon. Think about Amazon with all its warehouses around the country and its clusters of distribution centers and so on. They need to be unionized like yesterday. And the labor movement, for the most part, the leaders are not socialists, unfortunately, so they have no vision for this kind of mass organizing, which would have to be on an international scale, actually. You can't, even in a country as big as the United States, you have to have international links, strong links, meaning real partnerships, if you want to use that weird term, with unions in Mexico, Canada, and other places, because of the threat of capital just picking up and moving production. You know, there's right now no union in the world that I'm aware of that can successfully pull off a strike simultaneously, say, in China, Berlin, and, you know, Silicon Valley or Los Angeles, just to use some examples. And that's got to happen, not for the perpetual survivability of the labor movement, but as a part of because it won't last forever. I mean, capitalism will destroy itself at some point, along with the labor movement. But and that doesn't mean what comes after would be socialism. That has to be built. That has to be a conscious thing. Environmental destruction is not going to build socialism. Although socialism is the only way out of environmental destruction, because the level of planning and regulation and so on needed to do these massive sustainability projects, massive shift in production and so on, that can only be achieved through democratic planning of the economy on a world scale. And that's the definition of socialism right there, basically, the key essence of socialism. Under capitalism, there's no democracy in economic planning. It is, you could have some countries that regulate capitalism and that try to create laws that channel capital in a certain way, but they're very limited, very short-lived as well, historically. Again, think of the Scandinavian quote-unquote model that only existed for a short time. And not as socialism, by the way, but just as welfare capitalism and capitalism highly regulated, and that even that was precarious, as is shown now by its destruction. And that destruction of those social policies and so on. So you have a situation where, like with the environment, it's socialism or, destruction of the planet as in terms of being fit for human habitation through the environmental crises that are out there, global warming and so on, or the old nuclear war, crisis always looming under capitalism since the invention of and use of atomic weapons. Oh, by the United States, twice on civilian populations in Japan. Oh, how about that? Something to think about. Anyway, International Women's Day just happened, March 8th, and a lot of, even the corporate media mentioned a little bit, which was better than nothing, I suppose, although they didn't really get into what we're going to get into, of course, which is the socialist roots of International Women's Day. And why is International Women's Day important? I mean, in Socialist Alternative, there are meetings all over the country of speakers from Ireland, of all places, where because of the Irish capitalism and its links to and its use of the Catholic Church, things like abortion rights were almost unheard of. Just almost unknown. As recently as a few years ago, and things like sex education and abortion rights and women's rights in general were subsumed they were just repressed by the Catholic Church, acting as a functionary of the state. For example, in Ireland, the Catholic Church running the educational system and so on. And if you want to get into Marxism and socialism in a serious way, which I highly recommend, there's all sorts of works to read, one of the beginning works of tying material, meaning scientific analysis, to religion. There was, for example, Engels's book, Origin of the Family, Private Property, and the State. Religion not huge in that, but basically showing where these things came from and why, and the family unit as defined by capitalism, rules of how property is passed from generation to generation, rules, laws about that, to develop into a patriarchic centered capitalism. And all that, that's the beginnings of that. Kautsky, by the way, someone named Kautsky, Karl Kautsky, wrote a book called The Origins of Christianity. And there's many other books that take a sort of a socialist, sort of scientific, it tries to be the science of the times, as scientific as possible, to analyze how religion was used by class societies, slave societies, feudal societies, and capitalist societies, as a way of extending the power of the capitalist class, extending the power of the state run by the ruling class in any of the class societies, and using those using religion to control and to repress. What might spring to mind to a lot of Europeans or Americans would be the role of the Catholic Church under feudalism, but that's just one example, unfortunately, of many. And that isn't totally gone, but in Ireland recently there were some defeats of that rule of the Catholic, of the capitalism slash state slash Catholic Church troika, if you want to say that, they had a huge setback based on a mass movement that the Socialist Party of Ireland, which is part of Community for Works International, had a big role in, and other left groups and just big sections of the population have had it with the Catholic Church. There, a lot of it has to do with the horrible scandal, the pedophile scandals, the assaults and rape of children, endemic to the Catholic Church and in Ireland and other places. That, of course, fueled a lot of the anti-Catholic anger. Little too late, as far as I'm concerned. But it fueled that anger. But also just the fact that there was a woman that died in Ireland because she had a complicated pregnancy, needed an abortion, and was not, and Ireland's abortion rights were very minimal, and she didn't fit the really strict criteria of an abortion. This is about 2 years ago, I think it was, and she died. And that also triggered this movement. And the movement became known, there's different movements, but one of them was called Rosa. And this movement became a mass movement. There are members of the Socialist Party in Parliament in Ireland, and they fought on this movement as well, fought for this movement. And long story short, just within the last year, better, not perfect, but better reproductive rights, abortion rights were brought in, were won through struggle, through mass protest and so on. And the role of the Catholic Church was hit, was given a few hits, which is great. And they were they're in retreat in a popular manner in terms of opinion, but also in terms of like ability to control things in the state. And it was basically a really good victory. And for International Women's Day, there were meetings organized by Socialist Alternative around the U.S. with speakers from Ireland. We had a meeting in Boston, meeting in Worcester, around here, who talked about that movement. But, you know, the history of the International Women's Day, again, March 8th, in case you missed it, hopefully you didn't. There were no big protests in the U.S. that I'm aware of on International Women's Day. And you might ask yourself why. I'm sure some of our listeners are. Because you have the rise of the Me Too movement. You have, more, I would argue, not just around Me Too, but in general, more women getting involved in politics. Unfortunately, that's often Democratic Party politics or Republican Party politics, but also there are other places where that's happening, including in socialism. I mean, I'd say the most radical, and I mean that in the good sense, the most sort of socialistic, most part of the population most interested in socialism is actually young women right now, women in their late teens to early 20s. And for obvious reasons, economically, the whole millennial thing or the whole, I'm trying to use shorthand here to get back to the original point on International Women's Day, but basically the objective conditions for most working people being women around the world, including the United States, is that the so-called boom isn't reaching most working people. And the Great Recession of 2007-2008 is still being felt over a decade later. And basic things like being able to afford college, being able to afford housing, rental housing, or buying a house, basic things like transportation costs, these are health insurance, these are all huge, huge costs. And we're told inflation is low, and yet these costs can literally break you. You know, and I'm speaking from experience here. They can literally set you back decades in terms of, being deep in debt, seeing no way out, et cetera. And that's the objective thing, and along with that is, for example, if you really look at things like access to abortion, it's been actually disappearing in many areas of the country. Whether under Democratic, like Clinton, under the Clinton regime, there was a big retreat in back in the 90s in accessibility to abortion, because Clinton was a big states' rights guy, and also the Clinton administration cut aid to families with dependent children, dumped that back on the states. A lot of states cut that, so women suffer the most from that. Poor women, working class, I include
so-called poor women in working class, in the working class, obviously, so working class women suffer the most from that. And that's never recovered, okay? That's never been, like, you know, there's been no attempt to undo the damage of the last 30 years of stagnant wages and so on, but actually cuts in social benefits. I mentioned earlier in the show, for example, subsidized childcare, which was a big fight in the 70s, and some people got it in certain workplaces that are for the state of New York, I know. That used to exist for unionized workers and so on. I don't know what the situation is now. And that's been peeled away, and nobody hardly talks about it anymore. And I didn't hear anything. But anyway, the original point was that International Women's Day. Didn't hear anything about subsidized daycare, International Women's Day, by the way. But I think Elizabeth Warren actually brought out something like that, some talk of that. Not sure about that. But everything Elizabeth Warren says, I'm like, oh, okay. But you like capitalism. Oh, okay, but you're a Democrat, you know? I mean, it's really, I followed her career, and she unfortunately will, with very little provocation, defend capitalism as vociferously as Nancy Pelosi, and will just subsume whatever real changes are needed to the goal of keeping capitalism keeping within the parameters set by capitalism. Now, right now, there's a left populist bulge, so to speak, in the parameter, out of the parameters, or pushing the parameters of capitalism, seemingly in a progressive direction. The problem is that to say that, oh, Democrats are turning left as a blanket statement is pretty ahistorical, because there's been other times where Democrats have definitely pushed their rhetoric and even some of their policies in a progressive or so-called left direction. And that's to, you know, try to keep people interested, try to win some votes. And once in power, those things can be defunded very quickly. And they are, usually. I mean, there have been even laws passed by Democratic Party dominated Congresses of full employment laws and so on, things that sound really, really nice on the in rhetorically, but they're not really organized for, they're not really kept, they're not really funded, so it's just kept at the level of rhetoric. You see that with a lot of the $15 an hour minimum wage laws that are being passed around the country. I mean, Social Alternative and others have fought really hard for these where we have the ability to, including Shama Sawant and Social Alternative helping to lead the fight for the first successful $15 minimum wage law in Seattle, Washington, back in 2014, I believe it was. But once it got to the final stages and the Democratic Party glommed onto it, they immediately started watering it down with phase-ins, they called them. Now, every 15 law has phase-ins now, and that just means delaying it, basically. You delay it as much as possible. So we have $15 minimum wage laws on the books, and it's a step in the right direction, even with the phase-ins, but come on, you didn't need the phase-ins. The phase-ins delay it, in many cases, to 2004, I've seen. I'm sorry, 2024, sorry, not 2004, 2022, 2024. And these phase-ins are deadly, literally. I mean, because 15 is not a living wage. 15, we all know that. Everyone that's fought for 15 is never going around saying, well, at least Social Alternative is not going around saying, hey, 15, living wage. So 15 is a step towards a living wage, a necessary step. And now you're going to see Congress, supposedly, there's a bill, we'll see what happens, where that debate is going to happen in Congress. But you'll see immediately the Democrats, carving away important things that, you know, of implementation of people that are, like, in some places, you still have this separation of tipped employees not getting the 15. Clear example of that we've talked about on the show is in Washington, D.C., where the 15 law was targeted actually to tipped employees, and passed a referendum. The people voted for it. 60-something percent of D.C. residents voted for a referendum that was going to raise the wages of tipped employees, like, you know, waiters and so on, to 15. And the Democrats then said, and, what, you know, totally dominate the Washington, D.C. City Council, said, oh, no, we don't like that. So most of them got together and just overturned it, passed a law overturning it within months of its the referendum happening. This is after the same mayor, Democratic mayor of D.C., had shot down a 15 proposal like 2 years ago, I think it was, for everybody, or all workers in D.C. Again, it gets back to that point earlier in the show of lesser evilism. You know, if all you're focused on is Trump and you ignore all the evil the Democratic Party does as defenders of capitalism, as part of the capitalist system, along with the Republicans, of course, then on a local level, right, and all you see is the evil that Trump is doing nationally, you're not going to get rid of Trump. There's going to be another Trump. There was Reagan. I was alive during the Reagan administration. I remember as a child, the Nixon administration. Read up on that one, please. Now, by the way, if you do the research, what's the key lesson from Nixon? Nixon was a horrible right winger, a real nut job, obviously. And the satire and the disgust around Trump was even more so around Nixon, because there was the Vietnam War and people just really hated Nixon. You know, sending their children off to die for nothing, for example, will make you really hate a president. And Nixon was just so unpopular at a certain point, despite getting reelected. You know, money will do that. Duopoly, lesser evilism will do that. You can get people elected, but once in power, and especially when this Watergate scandal hit, of course, boom, the hatred around Nixon was just palpable. And of course, they tried to rebuild him later and so on. But the point is that the movements that happened under the Nixon administration, the big mass movement against the Vietnam War, the women's movement, the civil rights, the Black Power movement, sort of tail end of the civil rights movement and continuing civil rights movement, the movement on environmental regulations around the environment in general, Earth Day and so on, became a big thing. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration, Roe versus Wade was passed. Abortion rights, fundamental abortion rights passed during the Nixon administration. Mass movements forced this administration that got reelected. I mean, when Nixon got reelected, people on the so-called left or on the left, liberals were stunned, right? But you have to understand, an election is just a snapshot. It's the mass movements that can, even if they aren't socialist, but if they're strong with a sort of, you know, vision, they won't solve the problem, but they can temporarily force major concessions from the capitalists, you know, no matter whether it's the Republican capitalists or Democratic capitalists in power. And that's a lesson from the Nixon administration that is not well learned, you know. Right now under Trump, for example, Trump could really be on the defensive. Trump could be out of office if all the energy that went into getting Democrats elected in the House, which dissipated energy around Me Too, around the women's movement. There were cities where there was no march in January for the women's movement because of they thought the work was done, that the Democrats were back in power in the House, and other reasons as well, but that was a big one. And there was, there's just this idea that, you just sort of, huddle down, try to get Trump out through some sort of scandal. The Democrats, see, it gets to a fundamental point, really, that the Democratic Party is not a party. The individuals in it, even the most so-called progressive ones like AOC and Sanders and so on, they're not about building mass movements. Sanders talks about that. He doesn't do it, though. He doesn't go out and build a mass movement. He doesn't use his office. He doesn't use his time to build a, you know, grassroots mass movement to take on certain issues, or a bunch of issues all at once. He basically says, you know, elect me and other so-called progressives, and we will then tackle that through, you know, legislation and so on. And I'm not making an anti-electoral politics argument. There's just the left doesn't have a hand in the game right now, despite, you know, propaganda about Sanders and so on. So at a national level, and that could change immediately if Sanders decided to run as independent and was serious about building a party along with that. That would be great. That would be really great. Because of the possibilities coming out of that, not because Sanders himself I mean, that, you know, he's quoted saying, I'm in the Democratic Party for life. So I'm not saying this is going to recently. So I'm not saying this is going to happen. But Sanders running as independent would channel all that energy away from Democratic Party electoralism, which is a fundamentally safe channel for capitalism, into a movement on the streets, even based on electoralism, but fighting for those issues that would scare the heck, you know, out of everyone from Elizabeth Warren to Nancy Pelosi, everyone from Trump to Pence or whoever. And you could get concessions even under Trumpism, you know, and you could get rid of Trump easier. You know, if it wasn't for the mass movements in the 60s and 70s, Nixon wouldn't be gone. You know, Nixon, they could have somehow kept him in despite Watergate, but they feared what would happen if they did that because of the mass movements they had just they were still going, but they had just really experienced hugely, meaning the ruling class. Very, very scared by the big movements of the 60s and 70s, even though that's nothing compared to what hopefully we're going to be experiencing in the future when the working class is more involved than they were in the 60s and 70s. Getting back to what we're saying about International Women's Day, not everyone knows, and I'm going to quote from an article here by Claire Doyle of the Committee for Workers International. You can go to socialistworld.net for more information. It's an organization that Socialist Alternative is in political solidarity with. So, yes, on March 8th, other countries, there were strikes, marches, protests celebrating International Women's Day. Not much aware of that happening here in the U.S., but we did do, Social Alternative at least did some meetings around International Women's Day in places like Providence, Boston, New York, Worcester, et cetera, a lot of places, L.A., I think, Oakland at least. Anyway, but here we go. Quoting, not all those who mark International Women's Day will know its historical origin in the strikes, struggles, and conferences of working and socialist women at the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century. It's also the day to honor the lives of women pioneers and socialists. We remember Eleanor Marx, the daughter of the great socialist theoretician and fighter Karl Marx, who worked tirelessly to build the strength of the workers' movement, male and female. We honor the heroic revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg, brutally murdered a century ago this year. I think there's a little more on that. Yeah, here we go. Chosen by socialists in 1910, International Women's Day has been a day for women workers to strike and demand a better deal. Hold on one second. I just wanted to check something here. A little glitch here. All right, that's fine. Sorry. A little... sorry. That was a little technical glitch. Chosen by socialists in 1910, International Women's Day has been a day for women workers to strike and demand for a better deal. It was this day in Petrograd, Russia, 1917, that women textile workers left their machines to march to the Tsar's palace, demanding food for their children and an end to the devastating war. So International Women's Day has its roots in the socialist movement and in the Russian Revolution. When workers from the neighboring, that's part of the socialist movement, obviously. When workers from the neighboring factories downed tools in response to the appeal of the women workers, the Russian Revolution became unstoppable. When the Bolsheviks, the Bolshevik Party took power 9 months later and was elected into the leadership of the Soviets, the mass workers' councils in Russia, among their first decrees were sweeping reforms to change the lives of women. The promise of, quote, a new life, unquote, for working women in the cities and the countryside on the basis of the state ownership at that time run by the Soviets, run democratically, of land and industry, along with truly democratic planning, which was later broken up by Stalin's counter-revolution. This was a big promise, and it started to be implemented for women workers in Russia. It did not, because of the Civil War and Stalinism, it did not get happen, although even under Stalinism, there was more, women had more access to education, much more access to education and healthcare and so on than they did under capitalism and Tsarism. So anyway, there's you know, it goes on to, it goes into the contemporary International Women's Day, just, you know, right now, it's happening right now. For example, more than 10 years after the financial crisis of 2007-08, there's been no real recovery in the world economy. I was getting into this earlier. In most countries, growth is sluggish at best, and new generations of workers are on the scrap heap before they can begin to make a life for themselves. Personal debt and government debts have never been higher. Living standards plummet, or at least stagnate, even in the most prosperous of countries. In Europe and the U.S., policies of austerity have hit women the hardest. Many of the hard-won steps forward in the lives of working women are being reversed. Welfare services on which they depend and in which they work are being cut to the bone, and the care of the young, the sick, and the aged mainly falling on their shoulders. When I was talking earlier, for example, I'm not quoting now, obviously, about things that the precarious nature of reforms under capitalism. If you don't overthrow capitalism, capitalism comes back to constantly to retake lost ground, so to speak. So right now in the United States, what a generation after World War II, or more than one generation, thought was permanent, things like pensions, things like, you know, affordable housing, ever-increasing wages, these things are all, you know, gone for the most part. To a certain extent, I mean, there obviously wage increases still happen, but again, mostly wages have been stagnant. The latest sort of talking point in the corporate media is that, quote, finally wages are going up. But you have to take that with a grain of salt, because the distortions around inflation, as reported, are so severe in the United States right now, where you can have, for example, the costs of healthcare rise in hundreds of percentages. You can have the cost of, you know, higher education, college rising 500% or something. And then they say, well, there's low inflation. And I don't know about you, but if you're listening here in the United States, and by the way, we do go out internationally, and check out Socialist Alternative Radio on Facebook. And thank you to our international listeners, by the way, and national listeners by going to WMFO.org. But if you're being told constantly that inflation is low, and then you go out and like actually buy food or something. I mean, I went to one of the cheapest grocery store chains in the area. It's called Market Basket. Unfortunately, non-union, which I really hate. But I go there, you know, try to save some money. And that place is getting expensive, man. That prices are going up. If Diego was here, we'd have a whole talk about that. He used to work there. Prices are going up. And really badly. I mean, I'm spending way too much money on food and coming back with very little, you know, from the store. So coupled, you know, this coupled with, you know, cuts in things like, you know, food stamps, the things that started to become reforms in the 70s, like we talked about earlier, subsidized daycare, gone. Regulations on nursing homes, gone. So now you can, if you have an elder, if you're trying to take care of your parents or something, and you think that you're just going to slide them into a nursing home somewhere, that's just some sort of natural process. It's not. It's completely screwed over now, messed up under capitalism, where nursing homes are allowed to charge whatever they want, and they do. They'll charge $14,000, $15,000 a month. You will lose everything. Everything that the people that your parents saved will go to a few months of nursing home care. Everything you try to save will be, you'll be forced to pay out, or they've gone through their assets. You refuse to pay. They're declared, they're on Medicare, basically. They go down to Medicare, and certain things they can't get or whatever. And it's a nightmare. It's really, really a nightmare. And all that money just goes to profits of nursing homes. And it didn't used to be that way. You used to have municipal, you know, nursing homes, municipal hospitals, heavily regulated, couldn't charge that much money, even close to that much money. And there's nobody out here, there's no workers' party or left-wing party in the United States to educate people about these issues. You know, I'm sitting here trying, I was for years trying to research how did this become the case that a nursing homes can be closing all over the country, and at the same time, nursing homes, other the ones that stay open, are these big chains, and they're charging $14,000, $15,000 a month for people to stay there and get crappy care, by the way, on top of everything. Where did that come from? What was the regulations before and so on? And it's very hard to find out that information. But take schooling, for example, in the United States. A lot of people might not know this in other countries or whatever, but in the United States, the federal government does not pay for education. The amount of money going from the federal government to primary, school education, elementary school, junior high, high school, kindergarten, pre-K, is only 8% of the budgets. The states have to make up the rest, but they don't do that either by taxing the big corporations and the rich and then putting that money in education. They do it through tax revenue based on property taxes of the communities, of the cities and towns and so on, which means creates this educational apartheid, right? Based on who can afford the highest property taxes, right? So you go to the rich cities and you're not allowed to send your kids to the rich city school, right? The rich town. They're going to have right next to a poor town in many cases. They're going to have a well-funded school system. Probably still sucks in a lot of ways because the problems with education are deeply rooted in capitalist exploitation and education used to further that, not as an end in itself. But property taxes create a system of both sort of gentrification of areas. Of areas where if you want decent schools and the hope of a decent school, you jack up the property taxes and all the people that really need the schooling have to leave the community then, you know, because they can't afford the property taxes anymore. That happens in a lot of places. So the original point is all these things that seem to be improving, or some of them at a certain point in history, in the post-war upswing, have been taken away or are almost gone, almost totally gone. And that should be educating people about the precarious nature of, you know, reforms under capitalism and of what the nature of capitalism is, that there's it's just a race to the bottom without a check, and the check, you know, of a strong labor movement or whatever, that's not a static thing. It's not a thing that, oh, well, we've got, you know, certain, like in the post-war upswing, we had in 1953, 35% union membership in the country. And that created the situation where unions, based on their mass struggles of the 30s and 40s, they were able to scare the capitalists into concessions at a time when the capitalists were making huge profits in the United States in the post-war upswing, right? I'm not arguing, well, that's our goal to go back to that, because even that was not enough, not even close, especially for people of color. The post-war upswing, hence the civil rights movement and so on, was marked by huge inequality, and not just by race, by class as well. And it was never as good as they make it sound. I'm not trying to make it sound really good. I remember the 60s as a young child, still definitely poor people, still. My father, for example, working three jobs back when that was considered weird, in some cases, that people should be able to get by on one, with one job. And a lot of, problems that, you still had recessions during the post-war upswing. You had a deep, deep recession in 74, 75, which kind of ended the post-war upswing. So this kind of idea, this American dream mythology that forms at certain times and takes a while to dissipate, it is dissipating. That's back to the point of the socialist movement in the United States growing, and internationally, at least, fight backs around International Women's Day, not so much here, but in other countries. But basically, back to this article I was quoting from on International Women's Day, while the rich get richer, the overwhelming majority of the world's population live in what seems like unending poverty. A handful of billionaires own as much wealth as the 3.6 billion poorest half of the world's population. Even the capitalist class and its advisors are wary of the tsunami of revolt that could be already in the making. And then it goes on and talks about the Gilets Jaunes protest, the yellow vest protests in France, and other big protests that have been happening. And then gets back to basically women as the majority of working people around the world, as majority of the population, and yet suffering, from everything from the endemic sexual harassment and violence especially among poor, working in poor women, which is not so much evident from the propaganda around the Me Too movement, but there's little or no publicity for the millions upon Williams, I'm quoting again, millions upon millions of women who daily face sexual abuse and rape at work in the fields and the markets and the factories around the world. 71% of the 40.3 million people living in some form of modern slavery are women and girls. An additional 15.4 million people are estimated to be living in forced marriages. The overwhelming majority of the world's refugees and of the world's homeless are also women and children. In many countries around the world, around the globe, abortion is illegal, and rape within marriage is not recognized as a crime. But there are fight backs around women's issues, a lot of which we don't hear about here in the U.S. Scotland saw 8,000 city council workers, who are mostly women, strike for equal pay and win recently, with the support of other male colleagues taking illegal strike action to win that. There have been protests at Walmart, McDonald's, and Amazon. Issues of women's rights. There was a protest at Google that got a lot of play in the corporate media, which shows the potential anger. And there have been mass strikes of women garment workers, unhurt, don't hear about them here, in Bangladesh for a living wage, and walkouts of women on the tea plantations of Sri Lanka for wage increases. Mass protests against discrimination in India, against femicide in Argentina, Brazil, and Italy. We've seen women across the world involved in numerous protests on housing, abortion rights, against austerity. In Ireland, nurses and midwives have been on strike, in a struggle over pay and conditions. I think that's still happening. There's a myriad of ways under capitalism in which women are denied freedom of choice in their daily lives. It's incumbent on socialists to explain their origin and to be fully involved in campaigns to achieve real advances for working women. In other words, the need for socialist feminism. And it's a really good article. It gets into more of the history. I don't have time to go into it totally. Again, the article is called International Women's Day 2019 and Oppression with a Fight for Socialism, from socialistworld.net, March 6, 2019. Let's see. And it goes into what I was talking about, the reversal of services through austerity policies. Just when you think you've won something, it's taken away. And like, for example, cuts in domestic violence services, and fights back against those. Members of the Committee for Workers International have succeeded in reviving the tradition of striking on March 8th in the Spanish state last year at the initiative of the Sindicato de Estudiantes and Libres y Combativas, a socialist feminist platform of the CWI in Spain. Over 2 million students and workers walked out to protest the horrific levels of violence against women accepted by both the Catholic Church and the Francoist state. Francoist meaning the right-wing government in Spain. Again, on 14 November last year, more than 1.5 million students participated in strikes and demonstrations against sexism in the schools and in the legal system. And this year, with even more determination, there were strikes on March 8th in Spain. In Belgium, there were walkouts as well. Italy, and in the U.S., International Women's Day, fueled by Donald Trump and so on, and the appointment of Brett Kavanaugh as Supreme Court judge, there was, like we mentioned earlier, I'm not aware of that many big protests, but there were public meetings and so on, and there was the women's marches that did happen to a limited extent in January. Ireland, Poland, protests, Norway, Hungary as well. Now, there's a book written by a Socialist Party member in Britain that's part of the Committee for Workers International called, where'd that go? It Doesn't Have to Be Like This, written by Christine Thomas. I've read that. It's really good. Wish we had more material like it here in the U.S. About the need for socialist feminism. And one thing that another article to check out is by Sarah Sachs Eldridge from March 8th, also socialistworld.net, also Socialist Party in Britain, Committee for Works International. There's just one part in here. This sums up kind of a socialist approach to women's rights, and you can, I just want to, like, it's succinct, it's good. fight for socialism as being a part of the struggle for women's rights. Ending violence, discrimination, and oppression against women requires a fundamental transformation in the way society is structured and organized. A fundamental transformation in the way that society is structured and organized. You can meet plenty of people on any issue or series of issues, including, unfortunately, on women's rights or the environment or whatever, that say, well, you know, we can have equality under capitalism. Just break that glass ceiling and everything's fine. Well, it's not, because you'll still have the vast majority, even if you have had, like, you know, majority of women in corporate boards, or majority of women legislate, there had to be a majority or 50% of women in legislatures around the world. That's, some of that stuff has happened, and you don't see justice. You don't see women's rights increasing, because the capitalist system is about exploiting working people. That, of course, includes women. Women in the majority there, basically. So if you don't have that fundamental transformation, you're going to just have the exploitation continue with women capitalists basically doing the exploiting through the state or whatever, or directly through their corporations. Through democratic control, workers' control, and management of the major banks, corporations, moving away from a system based on inequality and exploitation to one founded on equality and cooperation, it would be possible to not just end the economic problems which women face, but to prepare the ground for eliminating sexism and cultural oppression, too. Movements towards collective action by workers, including the vital building of a mass workers' party, will be critical steps in the struggle for socialism. And that's certainly true of the U.S., too, in terms of all of it, but also the building of a mass workers' party, as we started to talk about. Now, where does this, what is something sort of concrete that you can do for socialist feminism, for women's rights, and the rights of working people in general, is that despite the horrors of the Trump regime and everything focused on Trump as an individual, there is independent politics still out there from a left, from a socialist and progressive standpoint. And as I mentioned earlier in the show, there's a person named Kshama Sawant, Kshama, K-S-H-A-M-A, Sawant, S-A-W-A-N-T. Kshama has been elected to the Seattle City Council twice, in 2013 and 2015, and with more votes in 2015 than in 2013. And as you'll see, she's if you talk to Jeff Bezos, the president of Amazon, the richest capitalist scum in the world, Bezos will say, probably consider Sawant one of his main enemies, because Kshama, Socialist Alternative, and others led a fight to put a modest tax. We would have hoped it would be more, but it was a tax on Amazon. TAX on Amazon, and it was the start. We got the Democrats to vote for it in Seattle. Then Bezos made some noise, got some traitors to the working class to make some noise with him, and within a short time, like I think it was within a month, the Democrats all but one reversed their vote. So it was Kshama and one other person who voted to keep the tax on Amazon, and that had already been won and passed, and they just reversed it. So they know who Kshama is, they meaning the capitalists. They're going after Kshama. She's running for re-election for her third time, or running for election for the third time, or re-election for a second time. Already, especially the first election, which got a lot of publicity, and the second election, especially around Seattle, showed around Washington State, the Northwest, showed millions of people not only that socialism is possible, in terms of getting people elected or real socialists and fighting for socialist policies, but also the immediate effect of that was the election in 2013 was the winning in 2014 of the $15 minimum wage. Because the whole, Kshama Sawant's campaign, Socialist Alternatives campaign, for city council in 2013 was there was a whole range of demands and programmatic points and issues and so on, which you need to have a comprehensive program that you're proposing, you know, so you show you have some analysis and some ideas about how to improve things, obviously, and you're going to fight for these things.